The new book, The Grifters Club, Trump, Mar-a-Lago, and the Selling of the Presidency, gives new insight into how politics and power really work in the age of Trump. The book is an account of the palatial resort where President Trump conducts government business with little regard for ethics, security, or the law, according to our next guests. They are the all-star authors who have been consistently breaking news about Mar-a-Lago for the Miami Herald. The book is written by four reporters. We are joined by two of them, Sarah Blasky and Nicholas Nehamas, who join us this morning to talk about the new book, The Grifters Club, Trump, Mar-a-Lago, and the Selling of the Presidency. Sarah and Nicholas, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
Thanks for having us on.
Glad to be here.
Sarah, let's begin with you. How did this project come about with the four of you?
Sure. So last year, I'm sure most of the listeners remember when Robert Kraft was charged with soliciting a prostitute at a South Florida spa. He was charged. All of the news organizations followed that story. And we, myself and Nick here at the Miami Herald, found a bit of a different story. What we found was that the former owner of that spa was actually a woman named Cindy Yang, who had been selling access to the president. This was her new business. She was selling access to the president. Come and take your picture with Donald Trump at Mar-a-Lago. And through her, we actually sort of discovered this world of access peddling and attempts to influence the president that were happening at the South Florida Club. And so that reporting just sort of expanded into the book, The Grifters Club.
So, Nicholas, when you looked into this and realized what you had before you, how did the four of you all work together in covering the various aspects of the story? And just give us a bit of a timeline of how it unfolded.
Well, you know, it was sure a lot to tackle. And the timeline is a little hazy in my mind because everything is kind of glommed together. But, you know, Sarah really took the lead in reporting out, you know, the angle of this book. We are not Washington, D.C. reporters. You know, we're not political reporters. We're local newspaper journalists in South Florida. And, you know, Sarah's idea here was that this is a different kind of book from all the other Trump books you're going to read. You know, this is a book that takes you inside Palm Beach, inside Mar-a-Lago, this extremely exclusive, you know, high society world that Donald Trump kind of bought himself into and really shaped who he is. So it's a very different picture told through different characters than any other Trump book that you're going to read.
Yeah, I think there's just a little bit here for everyone. So our colleague Jay Weaver, who is one of the co-authors on this book, is a federal courts reporter for the Herald. He's been around for many years at this point. He's well known in South Florida, and he has those kind of insider sources in that world. So if you're into the national security angle, you know, Jay's reporting is going to really appeal to you. Then there's Caitlin Ostroff, another one of our colleagues who used to be at the Herald, and she now is a markets and data reporter at the Wall Street Journal in London. And so she brought in some of these characters, one man who runs a hedge fund association in Palm Beach, who is talking about why Mar-a-Lago appeals to them. And then Nick and I are both on the investigative team at the Herald now, and we really dug into the individuals and the characters who are around the president day to day in his home, which is also this club that he makes money from.
So talk about that, if you can, Nick, this Grifters Club, for the title of the book, of course, but what Mar-a-Lago was to the president before he became president and is now since he became president.
So, you know, originally when Donald Trump entered the scene in Palm Beach in the 80s, you know, he was this brash playboy developer. He was, you know, he had a lot of money, but he didn't have status. And buying Mar-a-Lago bought him entry into this world that he had not been born into, you know, high society Palm Beach. And he originally wanted this historic mansion to be his winter home, but he quickly found, you know, he couldn't afford it. It was a white elephant, and he turned it into a club. And I think, you know, no one would disagree that this has been his best real estate investment by far. The property value has soared, and belonging to Mar-a-Lago is a huge, you know, it was it was a perk before he was president, and now that he's president, you know, demand has just skyrocketed because people know they can get close to the president of the United States at Mar-a-Lago if they have the cash to cough up. And, you know, Trump and the Trump organization have taken advantage of that by, you know, raising the prices, by promoting the club at every turn. And so it's really, you know, the crown jewel in his business empire at this point.
With all of that said, Sarah, I was surprised in reading the book about the security at Mar-a-Lago and ultimately even the IT. I mean, you point out that the Wi-Fi network there is insecure. It doesn't seem like a place, being a club, it doesn't seem like a place that is necessarily conducive for being a presidential retreat where actual business is being conducted.
Yeah, so I mean, the White House will tell you that they have set up secure locations for the president to be briefed, as they do anytime a president travels. We don't have the specifics on that, obviously, but I think the bigger issue is that this is entirely unique in American presidential history, that a president, you know, frequently visits and vacations at a club that's open to its 500 members and any guests they want to bring. And beyond that, those guests, unless they are scheduled to personally have a one-on-one meeting with the president, they are not even background checked by Secret Service. So the only thing you need to get into Mar-a-Lago is an invitation from a member and a photo ID. They don't keep track of who's been there week to week. They simply check your ID, and you might end up sitting at the table next to the president of the United States. And yes, if you go into Mar-a-Lago as a guest, you can sign into that unsecured Wi-Fi, no questions asked.
One of the things, Nick, that's also interesting is that you talk about this in the book, of course, but there was the summit with the Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. That became a time where a lot of people realized that this briefing was happening in the full view of people who were at the club. Give us a sense of what you all found out in the reporting of this book about that, because it turns out it's even more concerning than we originally thought it was.
Yeah, so that moment, which is when, you know, the president and Prime Minister Shinzo Abe of Japan got a notice that North Korea had launched a missile, you know, that scene has been widely reported, but we went deeper and actually, you know, got into the moment as it happened. And at that very second, a lounge singer, one of Trump's favorites, was performing for him. And, you know, he did his kind of host thing where he asked her to twirl around and sing songs for the prime minister. And then when they got the news, you know, we interviewed someone who said that, you know, the singer was kind of shocked and said, you know, Mr. President, I shouldn't know about this, because she could kind of overhear what was being discussed, apparently. And he responded, you know, it's just nukes. Sing us a song. And so I think that really illustrates, you know, the tension you have at Mar-a-Lago, where Trump is trying to be this, you know, magnanimous, charming host, which he's very good at. But, you know, then real life national security pokes its head into the moment. And, you know, later that night, after he had the classified briefing and gave a press conference with Prime Minister Abe, the president went to a wedding that was happening in the reception in the ballroom, and he gave a toast, you know, that was very well received. So on the one hand, you know, he's dealing with these matters of life and death, the national security, and on the other, he's toasting a happy couple. And that's, you know, the contradiction in Mar-a-Lago.
Sarah, when I you all probably aren't all that different, but when I'm sitting down talking to journalist friends, inevitably the conversation will turn to the emoluments clause and just wondering, well, how has that not reared its head here? And a lot of this has to do with the Trump Hotel, and our conversations, the Trump Hotel in Washington, D.C. But my God, Mar-a-Lago. So talk about emoluments and how that plays in here, and really leading to the ultimate question of, is what they're doing illegal?
So the emoluments clauses, there are two of them in the U.S. Constitution. One says that a sitting president cannot profit from a foreign government, and that a sitting president cannot profit from the federal or state governments of the United States. So those are known as the foreign and domestic emoluments clauses. And as you mentioned, there have been concerns, especially regarding Trump hotel in D.C., concerning, you know, foreign dignitaries and other emissaries from foreign governments spending a lot of money at those hotels, and whether or not that would be a violation of the emoluments clause, the foreign emoluments clause, which there have been lawsuits brought on those grounds. There have also been lawsuits brought on the domestic emoluments grounds, and those are the ones that we see applying more to Mar-a-Lago, although certainly experts and constitutional experts would argue and have argued that Mar-a-Lago also, like Trump D.C. Hotel, appears to them to be violating both of those clauses. At Mar-a-Lago, because the president spends so much time there, because he goes back and forth, he goes golfing on the weekends, especially the Secret Service ends up spending a lot of money at the club, and they have to rent rooms, you know, to use staffers from the administration or people from the administration rent rooms at Mar-a-Lago, and it ends up running up these bills. I believe that documented, and this is only a small portion, these are only the receipts that have been disclosed through Information Act requests. I believe that there's been at least $900,000 of taxpayer, U.S. taxpayer dollars spent at Donald Trump's various clubs, and that's obviously a fraction of what has actually been spent. Again, those are limited receipts. And so the question of whether or not this is legal, I mean, the Justice Department has said that it is. The Trump Organization has come out and, you know, said, oh, well, we're giving some money back when our, you know, members of foreign governments stay at our businesses, so we're fine. But I think the bottom line here, and we see this with Donald Trump over and over again, especially in Palm Beach, is that he has a tendency to act in whatever way he sees fit, which is usually what way is going to benefit his business, and then sort of dare people to challenge him over it, right? And so with this emoluments clause, yes, it's tied up in court. Yes, there are people on both sides of the argument. And frankly, we don't have an answer yet. We don't have a legal ruling on whether or not this is legal. But there is a lot of money, especially from the U.S. government, going into Mar-a-Lago.
Nick, I have time for one more question, and I'd like it to be this one. But when you look at ultimately this story and about Mar-a-Lago, I got a sense in reading the book that, I mean, Sarah just mentioned this, you had mentioned it earlier, that a lot of this is what we expect from Donald Trump. But this seems to fit into the culture of Palm Beach as well, for both you and Sarah and to your two other co-authors. I mean, this is your beat. Does it? I mean, is this sort of something that does fit in, or is it an outlier in some ways?
Well, it's a really good question. I mean, Donald Trump certainly has changed Palm Beach in a lot of ways. I mean, when he came in, he was seen as this tasteless vulgarian, but, you know, people found that his parties were fun and they wanted to go there and, you know, they wanted to hang out with him. He has this ability to make people feel at ease and feel like they're the most, you know, important person in the world, and I think that he kind of used, you know, that skill in politics, and is one of the reasons why he's become successful as a politician. But, you know, there certainly is a culture in Palm Beach where, you know, his supporters, they trust him to do the right thing, and, you know, these conversations about emoluments clauses don't really matter because they think he's wealthy enough that he's not going to be influenced by, you know, anything corrupt or nefarious. And if doing the right thing happens to make him a little money, well, you know, they would do the same thing too, is what they told us. And so I do think it, you know, He is a product of Palm Beach, even as he has kind of changed it into something a little, you know, brasher and sexier than they used to be.
The name of the book is The Grifters Club, Trump, Mar-a-Lago, and the Selling of the Presidency. Sarah and Nick, I thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you both on the program. Best of luck with the book.
Thank you so much.
Be well.
Really appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you. Sarah Blaski and Nicholas Nehamas are two of the authors of the new book, The Grifters Club, Trump, Mar-a-Lago, and the Selling of the Presidency. The book is published by Public Affairs. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.